we have had a very strong and important revival of interest in the esoteric teachings of the past in recent years. And among the various emphases that have come back into focus is the story of the adept tradition. I have studied that rather carefully, probably for close to 50 years, and have written extensively on it, so that my general position, I suspect, is fairly well established and known. But there is a new dimension that has been introduced into the problem, involving an adjustment with contemporary thinking. And this, it seems to me, is important enough to devote a little time and consideration to exploring it. The adept tradition, as we know it today, came from the past, and probably from the ancient Indo-Aryan civilizations of Asia. The earliest accounts that we have bearing upon the subject have certainly originated in India. And the Indian situation is somewhat different from anything in the West, so we have to orient a little to it. The Vedas and the great Puranas of India discuss the mystery of days gone by when the gods walked with men. We find the same myths and legends arising in other parts of the world. But in India we have a situation that has not been repeated anywhere else of a natural indigenous structure. The adept tradition in India unfolds through a series of mystics, esotericists, yogins, Vedantins, many other schools of thought, represented in the world by gurus or teachers. These teachers were part of a hierarchy. They were not tied tightly to any worldly organization, but they were tied to a spiritual descent from antiquity. The gurus accepted disciples on various levels of attainment and subjected them to extraordinary disciplines. East Indian religion in its primitive form was a highly disciplined system. Those who followed it gave their lives to the conquest of their own individual weaknesses. They began with all type of physical austerity. They restricted and limited all negative or detrimental propensities of temperament. They had to gain complete inward placidity. They had to have an overwhelming faith and a strength and courage which would enable them to overcome any delinquencies of moral or ethical character which they might have brought with them into this world. As a result of continual discipline, the disciples ascended from one level of teachers to another toward a mysterious spiritual structure, this mysterious world of the adepts and initiates, the invisible government of the earth. These people believed firmly that there was an administrative body composed of highly perfected human beings and, in some instances, teachers from other life waves who contributed to the protection and advancement of mankind. It was first appropriate and proper to recognize such an institution, invisible to the average person, unknown to a great many, but necessary to the construction and unfoldment of humanity. These teachers, invisible, these rishis, these arhats, were actually elder brothers. they contributed to the protection of the young souls growing up in nature. They were very much like the ancestors in a family, the elders. And as such, they were known in a great many nations and among many tribes and peoples. But the disciple had as his final goal that he might become worthy to be an instrument in the fulfillment of the divine plan. This divine plan originated by deity, administered by hierarchy, and finally disseminated throughout the world through spiritualized teachers. This was the mysterious structure upon which the future and destiny of the whole plan of things depended. Now, when we realize that in Asia we had this tremendous dedication, we can begin to understand why it is difficult to transfer that dedication from the highlands of the Himalayas to the condominiums of America. There is a tremendous interval here between the spiritual way of life and the highly economic, industrial type of existence with which we are generally familiar. Almost all the sacred books of the world, regardless of their nationality or their dating, include the factor of an invisible government, the overwhelming hierarchy principle. Theology has generally overlooked this in the West, but on the other hand, it is indispensable to an understanding of nature and life, and a great many philosophers have given a great deal of thought to it. In the first place, if we wish to assume the presence of deity and the Godhead, a trinity or a triunity in unity, and also realize or believe that this power controls, directs, and judges the existence of all living things, it becomes inevitable that there must be something in the interval between deity and humanity. It is inconceivable that deity can administer the whole universal procedure, either by itself or by means of a small group of divine beings. It is much easier to believe that this administrative structure, highly conditioned, highly developed, represents a complete technical structure of overgovernment, of divine administration. It is as though you said of a large corporation that a corporation like Standard Oil or General Foods consists of a president, a board of directors, and office boys. There has to be something between. There has to be managers, department heads. There had to be specialists in many different fields to administer a great corporation. And the universe is the greatest of all corporations, for its very structure is the basis of all integration, all organization, and all distribution of authority in nature. So it did not seem unreasonable to the Oriental mind that there had to be this invisible hierarchy, that there had to be a tremendous invisible machinery administering the visible phenomena of life, that this machinery had to take care of everything, from the motion of the cosmos to the sparrow's fall. There had to be a tremendous over something, greater than anything we can even imagine, as we look out into space and see a magnificent distribution of light in the sky, stars, galaxies, nebula, all kinds of structure out there. We have to realize that something is running this, something is ruling it, something is administering it. And the sages of High Asia were convinced that the visible world as we see it is merely an appendage to a great invisible process that we do not see, but which we can learn to appreciate or understand. The first step, therefore, in the training of the chelas, or disciples, the first step was to become aware of the importance of a great process behind the obvious, that there was something more to know than we can find in school books, that there were reasons for things that transcend the common economic impulses with which we are familiar today. It became evident to these ancient sages that man was not here simply to build a material world. He was not here to advance personal fortune or dignity or estate. He was not here to conquer. There was something much more important in life. Finally, he was here to be a servant of the tremendous plan which sustained him and of which he was a part. It didn't seem at all unreasonable, therefore, to these elders that the disciples should become aware of the need for this procedure, that having discovered that there was a purpose in life greater than the ordinary human purpose, that the disciple should prepare himself for this purpose, that he should dedicate himself to whatever improvement would make him valuable to the advancement of the grand purpose or the eternal principle of progress. In this concept, therefore, he went through disciplines which not only purified the body, but also relieved the mind of prejudices and conceits and opinions, and gradually unfolded what the ancient believed to be the most important part of man, and that was the extrasensory and spiritual basis of human existence. Ultimately, then, the idea was that each faithful disciple would in turn be promoted into a more important capacity, not to gratify his personal ambitions, but to give opportunity to the improvements which he had attained within himself. It was not that these improvements should make him proud or more worldly, or that he should use them to advance his personal fortunes. It was that these improvements made him more useful in the great purpose for which all life is basically intended. From this highland belief, then, came the doctrine that in the heart of Asia, there was what was originally the North Polar Cap, but that this cap has now moved due to other motions of the planet until it is in the desert of Gobi, and that here was a mysterious center, the spiritual core from which the invisible government of the world functioned in the material existence. This government impressed itself by means of enlightened, dedicated, illumined creatures, persons. Perhaps we would call them gods, but the Greeks like to think of them as heroes, an heroic order of life between divinity and humanity. And in the Odyssey of Homer, and the Iliad, and the Aeneid of Virgil, we find references to these heroes, those who had transcended mortal limitation, and at death were lifted up to become planets and constellations. These were symbolic terms to indicate the advancement of those who had appropriate dedications and lived to achieve victory over the worldliness and ignorance in themselves. If we consider, therefore, this Oriental point of view, we can see how it drifted into Buddhism from its ancient Hindu foundation. In Buddhism, we have the entire concept of the arhats and of the great teachers brought forth in a very simple and direct way, in which the universal laws were administered by dedicated human beings who had become worthy to receive instruction. The Lotus Sutra of Buddha, the great apocalyptic sutra, describes this procedure in which the divine beings from 10 galaxies assemble to hear the revelation of the lotus of the perfect law. The whole of Buddhism is a visible shadow cast by an invisible structure of integrities, insights, and dedications. It was made up not only of the higher orders of life, the hierarchies, descending into material existence, but mortals ascending gradually out of materiality and towards a divine state, so that in a middle ground, the divine and the human met in a solid dedication to principles and truth. We have the same teachings in Taoism in China. We have it in the Dervish philosophies and mysticisms of Islam. We have the prophets and the sacred teachers of the Old Testament. And we have the mystics and esotericists that arose in Christianity. All of these systems essentially had a dedication, a reason why human beings should be better than they might normally be. The idea of self-improvement in the esoteric tradition is very different from our concept of self-improvement in the mortal world. Today we think of self-improvement as health, as improvement of a state. We think that self-improvement is to be richer, to be more fortunate, to be more glamorous, to hold public office, to achieve distinction among others. And that knowledge is simply a method of organizing and reorganizing the structure of our material existence. Therefore, we spend many years training to be computer operators. We spend many other years in terms of becoming diplomats or scientists or doctors. We become involved in great professional dedications. We become artists and architects and poets and writers, musicians. But some way, for the most part, all of our efforts are directed towards the enhancement of our material estate. We seek fame, distinction, recognition, and honor in this world. The esoteric tradition approaches this matter a little differently. The question that they have always asked, and which has been difficult for most people to answer, is when we leave here, of what we have here, what can we take with us? Will a good education in accounting work for our favor in a universe in which accounting, as we know it, has no existence? Does wealth go beyond the grave? Is fame and distinction something that has significance outside of this world? And for the most part, if we think clearly and carefully, we have to answer in the negative. There is very little we specialize here that is good for us anywhere else. It is important simply because of the world we live in, the condition of society, the degree of advancement of learning and arts and sciences here. Beyond this, most of the attainments that we give our lives to can have no enduring significance. Recognizing this, it was easy for some of the ancient peoples to rise above the lure and temptation of material existence. This was one of the reasons for which the ancient scriptures were dedicated. There is another reason also, that assuming that it is possible for the individual to know more about the grand structure of existence, then it is also possible for him to do better here and now in his material state. The more understanding he possesses, the more secure he can become, not only in spiritual values, but in his relation to the material environment in which he lives. Now, as we go along from one country to another, we find various names for these mysterious higher personalities. We have various stories of where they came from and why they're here and how they function and operate. But essentially, we realize or recognize them mostly through symbolism, which is a language of pictures, or word patterns which we must interpret in terms of inner insight. If we imagine that instead of a world simply filled with space and dark holes in the nebulas, we recognize that behind a veil, what the ancient Mayas called the azure veil of sky, behind this was a tremendous structure, a structure so meaningful that it brought the individual down in absolute, abject humility. This type of experience was awarded to Jacob Behme, the German mystic, who in his meditations and mystical contemplations was given a vision of the way the universe opened up, the way that Dante saw the space, the cosmos, as a tremendous open rose with hierarchies upon each of the petals, that somewhere behind this blank wall which seems to surround us is a greater world than we have ever known, a world of purposes, of meaning, a world not bound to material or economic structures, but a world belonging to infinite life and its continuing manifestation for the purpose of the unfoldment of the spiritual content in all things that live. Now, as we go down a little further, we come to another interesting pattern that presented itself. About the beginning of the Christian era, perhaps a little earlier, there was a traffic between Asia and Europe. And this traffic centered in a few great cities like Ephesus, Antioch, and Alexandria. And we find the Edda tradition beginning to emerge in contact with Western peoples, particularly through Egypt. In this particular area, the Neoplatonists, the Gnostics, and several other groups of mystics began to teach more openly in the West the belief in this grand plan of things, the belief that everything in the universe was lawful, that there was no such a thing as an accident or a mistake, that all the unfoldments of life, evolution in all its manifestations, were part of one tremendous pattern, a pattern invisible to the common perception, but to be glimpsed or apperceived in meditation or mystical experiences. Out of this also came another elaborate Egyptianized form, and that was ritual. Here, dramatic presentations were given to aspirants and disciples and students that they might behold symbolically the great order of the world, that they might also experience within themselves symbolically their own place in this plan and how it assisted them in the dedication of life to significant purpose. This is perhaps the key to the whole thing. The dedication of life to significant purpose. From the Alexandrian time, we have the rise of things like the Hermetic philosophies. A mysterious adept, Hermes Mercurius Trismegistus, a strange phantom-like figure, was perhaps the first important Western concept of the adept. A mysterious power, the mind of God made flesh, the wisdom of the eternal, brought into a communicatable form in the great teacher. Hermes was considered to be the author of all the books that were ever written in the world. No one ever saw him. No one ever found out who he really was. No authentic history of him is known. Yet we are forced to assume that a tremendous motion in society does not arise from nothing. It has to have a core. It has to have a motivating principle. And this motivating principle, as Hermes, was invisible, but the source of a tremendous visible transformation in the life of humanity. So we find gradually the rise of systems in the West, the Kabbalists, under Rabbi Akiva's influence, and Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai gave us the Zohar, the Book of the Splendors, the story of the great face and the lesser face, the story of the eternal throne forever, surrounded by hierarchy, by tremendous emanations of beings purposed to the life and improvement of mankind. We have the same tradition in Central America, among the American Indian groups, and in North America. But we have the mysterious lodge in the sky, the mysterious abode of the wise. And in this mysterious lodge, where they sat in council forever, these wise ones, the olds and the trues, administered the fortunes of mankind. And the medicine priests were able to leave their material forms and go to the great lodge in the sky for instruction. And sometimes the priest took with him a disciple whom he taught also to depart from the material form and attend the great council of the sachems in the lodge in heaven. These are Indian beliefs of tribes widely separated, with no language in common, scattered over a great continent, and the three parts of that continent, North, Central, and South America, all with the same intuitive understanding of what is occurring. This intuitive understanding probably arose from the medicine priests, those who from birth were dedicated to the service of truth, who could have no assignment in life except to serve the need of the tribe. All these experiences brought many legends and myths and stories into existence. The mythologies of nearly all races and nations involve this mysterious circumstance. So now we will bring it down to our purpose, to the beginning of the 17th century in Europe, where for the most part our present thoughts on the matter are centered. Around the year 1614, a mysterious proclamation appeared in Europe called the Fame and Confession of the Fraternity of the Rosy Cross. It was signed, presumably, by the members of an esoteric order, an order that was not to be found anywhere in the mortal world, an order which never received candidates, but selected for itself those whom it regarded as worthy. This particular documentation, followed by the chemical marriage of Christian Rosenkreuz, caused a tremendous furor, for it was really nothing more or less than to introduce into Europe the concept of the over-government of the adepts. It met, as might be expected, tremendous resistance. It also met a great deal of hope and anxiety for its success in the hearts and minds of those who were seeking greater enlightenment. So for nearly 20 years, this particular group remained a phantom structure in the philosophy, science, and political life of Europe. During this time, many tracts were written, several hundred little publications were made, in which persons who felt that they were worthy to be contacted tried to make some contact with the Brothers of the Rosy Cross. Not knowing where to write, who to turn to, they published little tracts, hoping that they would come into the hands of the proper persons. This went on for years, but so far as is known, no one ever received an answer. No one ever had any direct contact in the sense of being allowed to enter in or share in this mystery. In Europe, probably the most important of the mysterious adepts was called Elias the Artist. He was the great patron saint of the alchemists, and alchemy became perhaps the front door to the gate to the shut palace of the king, as reported in some of the ancient rites. The alchemists were the ones who sought to establish a legitimate contact through self-discipline. The alchemists were following the yoga and Vedanta and Buddhist principles of Asia, namely that the only way to contact the hierarchy was through self-improvement. In some mysterious way, the individual had to do what Fitzgerald tells us in the Rubaiyat, where he writes, "And from my base metal must be made the key to unlock the door the dervish howls without." Somehow, the individual himself had to become the thing before he could discover it. So almost all alchemy, as Basil Valentine, Raymond Lully, and most of the great masters of the art admitted, alchemy was not a transmutation of base metals, but a transmutation of man, a complete reorganization of his own nature, the gradual release of the spiritual powers of the inner life and the power to control this way the functions of the outer body. So the moral structure of alchemy became its most fascinating aspect. But still, we have only legends. These legends, however, like the ones of the East, have persisted, have gone on, and have continued to intrigue us for centuries past, and will probably do so for centuries to come. Among those who achieved various degrees of enlightenment in these matters, the Church boasted Albertus Magnus, the mysterious priest chemist who achieved the transmutation. Then there was Paracelsus von Hohenheim, the mysterious chemist mystic, who gave to the world a tremendous amount of medical skill, knowledge, and has been regarded as the father of pharmacopoeia, or the preparation of medicines. Then there were others equally mysterious. Ripley, the old abbot, whose scroll described the whole growth of the human soul. And little by little, these mysterious persons contributed something to knowledge in a way that is a little difficult for us to even appreciate. And yet all of them, although writing at this time, said in their writings as apologists that they were not members of this mysterious society. Michael Meyer published an edition of the Laws of the Rosy Cross, but denied that he was a member. One after another, these people tried to reach the order, and it gradually all faded out. Not because it didn't exist or the people didn't have faith in it. It had already taken over in Islam. It was a powerful part of the life of Persia. Everywhere it went, it dominated. But it was always mysterious. The dervishes had their adepts, but the dervish had to wait. He could not hunt out and find these teachers for himself. So gradually things drifted along until around 1660, when it is presumed that another voice was heard out of this mystery of the adept tradition. This voice was John Hayden, a young man who was peculiarly adapted to be a transmitter of knowledge. He is this, actually, who more or less directly involved Bacon in the story, and probably was empowered to do so. But Hayden described the Brothers of the Rosy Cross as a mysterious fraternity inhabiting the suburbs of heaven and servants of the Generalissimo of the world. This is a very nice definition, and it was the definition that has influenced nearly every bit of thinking since. The problem was very obvious, and it sums down to what we have now come to believe to be the contemporary focus, namely that there is a mysterious integrity behind life. There are forces working for the improvement of mankind. Every great teacher of the world has admitted this. Most of them have declared that they were commissioned to bring their message, commissioned by this mysterious group that did not appear, but labored for the good of mankind. So we come to the present focus where the world, confused, disturbed, and in great tragedy of personal and collective existence, is beginning to go back again to the old idea. Is there a power beyond our own, by means of which all things move together according to law? If there is a tremendous invisible government of the earth, if the way that life is to go and the future of humanity and all other species is already established in an archetype, where are these mysterious powers? How can we contact them? How can we know more about them? And if we cannot know these things, how can we at least have a constructive faith in the power of these organizations or this mysterious government to regulate the destiny of empires? I think the Bible and most other books do give us a key. We are, I think, unable to study scriptures without coming to the conclusion that there is something beyond our ordinary human problems and efforts working to control and direct the destiny of mankind. That there is a spiritual purpose, a spiritual integrity, seems to be an inevitable necessity. It doesn't mean that we have to believe something fantastic. Rather, it seems as though if we did not believe this, we would fall into fantasy. That there has to be a plan. That this plan has to have resulted from a planner. And this planner, in turn, must unfold the plan through a proper organization of processes and beings capable of administering the divine purpose. So now we come down to the problem as it is with us today, that a gradually increasing belief is coming back to us out of the past, that there is a destiny that shapes our ends, rough-hew them though we may, that we are not floating on the surface of something that has no substance, that birth is not a beginning nor death an end, that we are not simply shipwrecked on a barren planet in space, where we must continue until we destroy the planet with our own ingenuity. These kind of thoughts are desperately detrimental. We can't live with them. We cannot live unless somewhere in our nature we believe that life is significant. And we look around us and find very little evidence on the material plane of a significant life. We have to go behind the azure veil. We have to try to imagine, at least, the tremendous machinery by which visible things are maintained. We have to realize that the universal construction, like the human body, the macrocosm, which is the same as the microcosm, according to Hermes, that these two structures are symbolic of each other, that both are involved in the mystery of creation. If we want to find the hierarchy in the material world, the most simple possible way of approaching this is to look around us. In London, Christopher Wren built the great Cathedral of St. Paul. They put a tablet in the wall saying to, if you want to know Wren, look around you. In other words, the building itself. If we wish to know the builder, look around us at the world as it is. Not just political and structural, but that world which man does not control, the mysterious world of life and life processes, the mysterious relationships of living things. More and more we are becoming ecology conscious. More and more we are studying the various forms of life that inhabit the planet. And we are becoming consistently more concerned with man's relationship to the rest. And we are deciding gradually that man must give more attention to his relationship with the divine life plan than with merely the advancements of his material fortunes. So with this thought in mind, we have the problem of the adept tradition coming back into focus. And we can say to ourselves, how are we going to administer this problem? How are we going to take something we can't see, dealing with persons and beings we cannot possibly actually visualize, and also dealing with principles with which we are not equipped to handle constructively. We have to go back to the same thing that was true in India. There is only one protection to the human being who begins to investigate the unseen and the unknown, and that protection is his own integrity. There is no possible way in which he can protect himself except by the constant protection of his own honor. He must arise above all personal considerations. The gurus of India, the first thing that they taught their disciples was that the individual is not to keep his mind on the possibility of his own spiritual perfection, that he is not to be concerned with being greater than somebody else, that those in the spiritual hierarchy who would become the greatest must be the servants of all, as Jesus told his disciples. Therefore, self-ambition, the desire for the fulfillment of some attitude in our own daily living, can be fatal to our integrity and lead into a great deal of self-deceit and open us to the deceptive processes of others. So in the first place that we have to try to do, where we're looking for something we cannot see, is to try to recognize that the real answer to this mystery lies for us in the gradual unfoldment of our own insights concerning life. Well, there are several ways of doing this, of course. There are in existence a great many valuable landmarks and valuable works that can be of assistance to us. The ancients, both of the East and West, have left us a fairly good description of what we're looking for. They have left us an understanding of the plan and pattern by which the world is directed. We have the right in the beginning simply to accept or reject. We can't do anything else. We can say, yes, I believe. No, I do not believe. Because at this point, there is no way of becoming certain. Certainty comes at the end of effort, not at the beginning of it. All things move from hope to certainty. All things move from faith to fact. The facts cannot come first, because they must result from the effect of faith upon our own conduct.